place to be from the bottom to the top.
Yeah, perfect, man. Thanks a lot, man. Keep doing that. Real heads, keep listening.
This is Tony from Planet Giza, and you're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Radio. This is the crib right here, so shout-outs to every station on here, and shout-outs to you, the listener. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the Conversation Lab. I'm Don Schaefer.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me.
Where we once sang sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will never hurt us, in response to being taunted and insulted, this idiom, like so many other childhood memories, turned out to be untrue. The words we use have taken a deeper significance, and they can be extremely hurtful and painful. Sticks and Stones, Roots and Bones is the name of this podcast series, and it's part of my dissertation project as we explore the science, psychology, cultural, and emotional components of these conversational ecosystems and what they have in common to gain insight and improve on existing knowledge of how we engage with each other, whether about climate, race, gender, culture, politics, or social justice issues. I hope you'll join us. In this episode, we're joined by Vanessa Feloy, who's one of three co-founders of the Held Collective. I'm thrilled that we can talk about their work and what they do, and hopefully dig into some of my dissertation questions about polarization and how to navigate difficult conversations. The Held Collective is a partnership of facilitators, culture creators, and practitioners building a world liberated from oppressive systems, dynamics, and relationships. The three founders are Vanessa Feloy, Alexander Lyons, and Priya Ghai. So to get started, do you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and why you do it?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Vanessa, Vanessa Feloy, and I use the pronouns she and her. And who am I in the world? I am a Black British Nigerian woman living in East London, born in London, not raised in London, and have got quite a like meandering kind of life journey, if you like. I was born in London, like I said, and then moved to Oxford, like spent the large part of my adolescence, or actually all of it, in Oxford, and then flew the nest when I was about 18, went to university in a different part of the country, and then from university lived in Spain for 5 years, and then lived in Canada for a couple of years where my family lives, and then eventually found my way back to London, which was the last place on earth that I thought I would end up. But like, here we are, all roads lead back to the birthplace, apparently. So that's a little bit about my, I guess, like cultural socialization. And in terms of what I do in the world, I work as an educator, a facilitator, a practitioner, and a consultant in collective liberation education, alongside my two co-founders and friends, Alex and Priya. And the three of us are Held. So I do that in the world, and that's quite a big part of my life. And then I also am a DJ. So I work 4 days a week, which is a great place to be. And then DJ at the weekends and I play a lot of world music, so music from all over the world, because I'm a traveler at heart. Like, I chase the sun, like, honestly, and which is a huge reason why London was the last place I thought I'd end up, because I haven't got that much sunshine. But I love the sun, and I love reflecting my life's journey through sound. And all of the different countries and cultures that I have been, that I've had the pleasure of experiencing, and also the discomfort of experiencing in different moments as well, that have shaped my worldview. I am also a mama of two cats, Spritz and Martini. I live with my partner in our flat here in London. It's 1 year that we've moved in, so finally feeling quite settled after quite a long period of being on the road. And I guess the final thing to share about me is like who I am growing into in terms of like evolutions or versions of myself, and doing so with real intention, is bridging worlds, movements, people, organizations, divides, difference. For some reason or another, my calling in this world is to have the capacity to to be a bridge for people to come together. And unity is a really, really important thing for me. So that is definitely something that I feel called to do. So that takes up quite a lot of my time and thinking. And when I'm not doing that, I'm playing music, I'm going out clubbing, or I'm eating Chinese takeaway. That's probably all of the highlights about who I am.
And such a great city to do all that in.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I very much enjoy London for how much of the world is in it. And also it could be a little bit sunnier sometimes, honestly.
On your website, it says that you are an anti-oppression and collective liberation practitioner. Can you unpack that for us? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anti-oppression is a discipline, a practice, a paradigm that recognizes oppressive structures and systems in the world and the ways in which we are conditioned by them. And so to practice anti-oppression is to understand, is to first of all be able to locate where oppression lives, which first frontier is within ourselves, how we think, how we move, how we relate to the world and the people in the world and ourselves in it. And then to start to think about what do I need to shift, dismantle, and transform in order to actively challenge the ways in which we either uphold systemic oppression or reinforce it or kind of more deeply entrench it and so on and so on. So like the tradition, if you like, of civil rights movement, of anti-apartheid movements, of anti-racism movements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and thinking about all of the different kind of oppressions and marginalizations that unfortunately exist in this world, the tradition of justice often comes hand in hand with anti-oppression. And so when I talk about being a practitioner of anti-oppression, I often refer to myself as an educator of anti-oppression. And actually, what I love about your question and what it allows me to speak into and answer is that it's not just about educating, teaching, and facilitating other people to practice anti-oppression and collective liberation as ways of being in the world. It's also about how do I practice that? And actually, like the first frontier, the first practice ground or site in which I can really kind of influence and change is within myself and the way in which I relate to other people. And so that practitioner part is actually very, very important in that it's not just about educating the world outside of myself. It's about practicing the world I'm trying to create within myself as well. And that's what I would say about anti-oppression. And then collective liberation is really the most simple way that I would describe collective liberation as a question, which is how do we create a world in which we all get to be free? Every single one of us, without exception, without condition. And that is the question that I'm constantly trying to answer. And so how do we create the conditions for that liberation that we all get to experience? Yeah, without a condition of like, we need to be a certain way or show up in a certain way. So yeah, that's what I would share about anti-oppression and collective liberation practitioner, my day to day.
I love your beautiful question. It's something that you can really sit with. Can you talk about the Held Collective? It says on your website that you support people, movements, and organizations in building relational skills and cultural practices rooted in collective liberation. I also read that when the three of you came together, that you brought in each of your different values being different. And as your partnership deepened, they turned out to be not so important as the ones that you were building and living together. Can you talk about that journey of how the Held Collective has come together and what it was like then and what it feels like today?
I love the story of Held and the way we came together and our journey into being who we are today and who we're becoming in the world. I love our story because it symbolizes so much, in my humble opinion, of what is required in doing this work and in creating and transforming worlds from the inside out. So as I mentioned, I co-founded Held with Alexander and Priya. And we have been a partnership now for 3.5 years. However, we have been facilitating anti-oppression education in total together for 7 years. We used to freelance for a few different organizations. And as we got towards the end of that particular phase of working before we created Held, we started to feel the impact of facilitating diversity, equity, and inclusion and anti-oppression education and workshops and immersive programs. We started to feel the effects of facilitating that work personally, but also we started to feel an incongruence, a gap or a discrepancy between what we said we were doing in the world and actually what we felt we were doing and what we saw happening in our workshop. So we decided to hold space for each other in order to kind of work out like what was this feeling, what was this like unease, what was this feeling of being outside, being out of our integrity, what were the personal impacts of doing this work, like, and just like get into a place of like sharing that. And something that we realized is that the way in which we were facilitating that work was often reinforcing the very ways of being and dynamics that we said that we opposed. The very same dynamics that we were talking about dismantling in terms of anti-oppression work. One of them, to give an example, being superiority. And so we would find ourselves going into workshops, believing that we were the like crusaders of truth and rightness, that we knew best, and that anybody who would challenge us or anybody who would disagree with us in terms of their lived experience or what they felt and thought in the world, they just didn't know. They didn't know that on their journey, one day they'll understand. And it was this very kind of top-down directional teacher-student kind of dynamic. And we saw the consequences of what that created in the ways in which we were facilitating the work, and then took stock together. And we're like, what's happening here? Like, why is there so much kind of friction and conflict or compliance in our workshops when actually what we're trying to create is a world in which everybody can access freedom, safety, belonging, dignity, and so on? And so that's how we came together, as well as also, it's important to say, sharing space in order to feel through the impacts that it was, the kind of the cost or the toll that it was having on us on a day-to-day, as we understood the world at a more kind of granular and micro level, the deeper we went into that particular paradigm or lens of like of anti-oppression and diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it was having an impact in that, for me, I'll speak from my own experience, I was suspicious and paranoid of everyone, that everyone was out to get me, that I was stuck in a position of powerlessness and helplessness because I'm a Black woman in the world, two marginalizations that I hold, and in terms of my identity, and that there was no way out, that my life would always be shaped by that kind of predetermined, I guess, dynamic. And what we saw ultimately was that the work we were doing the way we were doing it was creating these binaried ways of understanding or seeing each other, rather. I'll like be careful with my words. These binaried ways of seeing each other that ultimately created more division and never created the opportunity or the moment for us to come back together and think, okay, understanding the ways in which our identity shape the way we think about the world and the way the world treats us is important. And it doesn't end there. There's more possibility than just, I will only ever be this and you will only ever be that. And so kind of thinking and feeling through all of that, we held space for each other for some time and then eventually realized that that was something that we wanted to contribute to the world and share with other people. And we thought it would be useful. And so Held, in holding space for each other, the name was born. And so I think the last 3.5 years of us being in a partnership together has been about us holding each other and really pouring into the quality of relationship that we have with each other in order to do the work that we do. And when you mention about the journey that we've been on and in terms of the values that we hold to be important at Held, I think what's funny about that is that when you go on any organizational website, for example, there will be a list of values. And actually what we find in working a lot with organizations, trying to do values work in order to shape their organizational culture is that they're often, how can I put it? We often talk more about the values than practice them. And okay, like I have compassion with that. And it held what we realized was that when you name values that you want to practice or that are your kind of orientation, if you like, for how you make decisions and how you behave, they're often aspirational, and that makes sense. But it was almost like we had values that we aspired to, as opposed to what are the actual values that reflect what we understand to be important about moving through the world together. And so I think that initial list, and I can't remember what they were, and perhaps that's telling, that initial list was maybe more of the like aspirational squared kind of values, as opposed to actually what are the values that we hold on to, that we come back to every time we are at a decision point, every time we are unclear about how to navigate something. And actually over time, the values that we have now are the values that actually more organically and truly we come back to. And so that's been the journey with the values, and actually being like, what's actually guiding us, as opposed to what do we want to say is guiding us, and then be in that, constantly be in that, like, in that dissonance of like what we say we're about and what we're actually about. So yeah, that's been our journey with our values, and that's been the journey that has brought us together in doing this work from a place of both inner transformation and actually trying to understand what it means and what is required of us in order to transform the world in a way that doesn't replicate the dynamics that already exist, that we say we want to dismantle and oppose.
I think it's beautiful that the three of you found each other and that you allow space for that self-reflective process. I'm curious, why does it take us so long to identify or reach into ourselves to determine what our values are?
There's something that I want to do before I answer that question as well, because I think from this point, everything that I answer is not only a reflection of the work that we've done at Held, so myself, Alex, and Priya being in deep partnership together, but also of several bodies of work and knowledge and traditions and histories and practitioners that like our work is a culmination of. And so I want to name a few people and give gratitude because we learn from those people, and they're definitely very kind of everything that we share in and that I share in this interview is very reflective of their work. And so Dr. Jennifer McCabe, who does deep and precious work in sovereignty, in personal sovereignty, visionary leadership, unconditional positive regard, and relating to difference. My life has been changed by the work that she does in the world. Also, Adrienne Marie Brown, who is a transformative justice activist and organizer, and maybe I hope she wouldn't mind me saying, but a bit of a celebrity on Instagram these days, has written a very influential book called Emergent Strategy. Sarah Shulman, who's written a book called Conflict Is Not Abuse, which is all about conflict transformation, as well as Luna Hewson on conflict transformation work as well. And then, you know, our work straddles Black feminist theory, conflict transformation, transformative justice, anti-oppression and sovereignty work. And so those are just a few names that I draw on in this interview. And so I wanted to name that in a space of gratitude and humility, and in reflecting the interdependence of doing this work and challenging the often quite shiny and tempting myth of individualism, that like, oh, I just came up with all of these ideas myself. And that's just not the case at all. So back to your question, why does it take us so long? Why does it take us so long to look into and reach into ourselves for the values that we actually are guided by? I think because we have been conditioned in the world to live in many different versions of should. Should be this, should do that. I should say this. And being in that constant judgment of doing things the right way, or I should be like this, I think often distracts us from what we actually have. What we actually have that's actually important to us, that actually guides us in this world. And a lot of what I've just said, I've learned from the work of Dr. Jennifer McCabe in being in this, constantly being in this, or trying to chase and be this version of myself that I think I should be. Instead of what I actually am and who I actually am and what I actually believe. And so I think it takes a lot of work to peel back those layers and of should, and actually get to the heart of this is what I have to contribute or create in the world. These are the values that I actually want to live my life by. I move through the world with a few different vision statements, visions that guide me. And I'm currently working with a professional vision that I don't like the wording of. I don't like it. I think it's clunky, you know, like it doesn't have a poetry to it. It doesn't have, it's very simple. And yet it's what I have. It's exactly names what I have. And I've had to do the work to be like, okay, I don't like how it sounds, but that's what's guiding me about what I'm trying to build in the world. And so I think we can get distracted in trying to make it something, or trying to make it our values something that they're not, or trying to be someone that we're not. And I think we're constantly avoiding getting really congruent with what do I actually have? And it takes time. It takes time to like peel back those layers and actually start to see what are the values that are echoing through the work that I'm doing. And so to give an example of that, a value that we haven't at Held, we haven't named on our website yet, but I see it in our future, is the value of discernment. And it is something that we are constantly coming back to. You will hear us refer to the ability to discern, and that is part of what we're building in the world in terms of people's relational skills and cultural practices. The ability to discern in the complexity of life is really important. And it's only by listening to ourselves that we can hear that actually that is a value that is always guiding us, whether we like it or not. The question is, are we willing to accept it and then name it and then commit to it? And that's the process that we're in as well. So, you know, there's always a journey in it. But I think it requires the journey of finding what are the values that I actually hold true in this world, require time, commitment to going after, and it requires a self-acceptance that the world doesn't teach us to have.
I'm quite struck by the time you took and the gratitude you gave to those that came before you, to those shoulders that we stand on. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That was very nice. And I love your answer, because it's something that we really just can't quickly come up with a list of our values.
Right.
It does take a lot of heart and time.
Yeah.
You were talking about layers, which reminded me of Stephen Sondheim, was an American composer and lyricist. And in an interview with D.T. Max in The New Yorker, he said, "My idea is that every moment of human intercourse, like right now between you and me, there are 64 of you in this room and 64 of me in this room that we bring into a conversation. So every sentence we say is filled with layers." And you were talking about those layers. And I'm curious how Sondheim's words resonate with you.
How we interpret, how Held interprets that wisdom of Stephen Sondheim and the 64 versions of ourselves in any kind of given interaction is that we recognize that there is a lot going on when two people or more are in relationship together and are in a particular interaction together. There's a whole lot going on, and we're not even talking about the context necessarily of, like, you know, where are they, what time of day it is, what are the conditions that are shaping the conversation, which I think is also important in terms of bigger picture thinking. having worked with many, many activists who are in situations of conflict and polarization, what we started to notice over time at Held is that there became this kind of internalized belief that that the people in conflict were solely the problem. And I'm doing inverted commas around the word problem, because conflict doesn't have to be bad. And actually what we constantly see time and again is that the organizational conditions or the contextual conditions that two or more people are in when they're in conflict are also contributing to that conversation. And so it's also important to zoom out and see like what are the contributing factors that are creating a particular interaction, right? So that I just want to like, first of all, share that framing that there is more than just the people in it. There's more than just the 64 versions. And I'll get to a little bit of that as well. I think in zooming into the versions of ourselves that are in a particular interaction or intercourse, there's a few things that we say at Held about that, which is, first of all, looking at what is shaping/influencing the way in which we think, the way in which we behave, and the way in which we relate to each other as human beings. And one of the lenses we can think about are all of the different identities that we hold from a social identity perspective. So social identity being the very kind of large scale categorizations of human beings under which we share a particular identity, such as race, gender, faith, sexual orientation, class, migration status, and so on, ability, right? And so on and so on. So we have these different social positions in relation to systems of oppression, or in relation to marginalization or privilege. We have this kind of spectrum of identities. And all of those are often at play in how I am showing up in a particular interaction, given my privilege, the English language being my first language, given my middle class privilege, given my able-bodied privilege, given my cis privilege, and so on and so on, of which I have several different social identities that hold privilege and power. And so those are contributing to the way in which I will be in an interaction with someone, as well as my marginalizations as well. And so there's all of those versions of myself that are in some way shaping how I show up. And then there's the kind of the personal identities that are not about social identity, but are more kind of unique to me. So my personality, my political affiliation, am I extroverted? Am I more introverted? What my kind of general beliefs are in the world. Let me see what else, like what I hold to be important in the world. All of these things that are specific and personal to me, Vanessa, as an individual, also playing a part. So there's those different kind of versions of myself as well, and how those different versions are influenced by the context that I'm in. I love this question because it really allows me to unpack like all of the different parts of ourselves in a particular interaction, which is everything that Held thinks about all the time. Then I would say there's the kind of like frozen parts or frozen versions of ourselves. So there is like 14-year-old Vanessa who experienced a particular thing and made a particular decision about how the world worked, which formed like part of my worldview, or even the unconscious traumas that I experienced as a young child, the ones that I remember and the ones that I don't. And all of those like different parts of myself that have been frozen in a particular moment or in a particular situation, in a particular history, which leads me on to the last kind of thing that I was thinking about with the 64 versions, which is like the histories that I'm part of or that I'm coming from. You know, we could talk about trauma, and that's obviously something that is quite loud on the global stage right now in terms of the consequences of collective trauma, intergenerational trauma, the history of oppression that lives within me. And histories of privilege, histories of power. And so there's also like all of that that's between us as well. And something that the Othering and Belonging Institute, I think John A. Powell talks about, is how in any given conversation, particularly in the United States and North America, in any given conversation, there can be 400 years of history that are between two people in conversation. And so, yeah, I think the idea of like 64 versions of a person or people in conversation is a useful one in order to understand who is in front of me. What part of you am I speaking into right now? What version is being activated by what I'm saying to you right now? Like there's just a lot more complexity than we usually allow for on the surface level of a conversation. And the art or the challenge is how do we go deeper and really get to understand and relate to each other in a way where we can identify, that's the version of you that I am either projecting onto you because of my stuff that I've got going on within me, or that is coming up for you because of a particular experience or history or positionality that you're speaking from.
I think the three of you gave a conference, Barriers to Bridging Building Relational Skills. Mm-hmm. And this is what that's all about.
And I think in speaking into that workshop a little bit more as well, in naming like, what does it mean for HELD to build the relational skills and cultural practices for people, organizations and movements in the world that are rooted in collective liberation? It's and thinking about barriers to bridging specifically, it's recognizing all of the dynamics and ways of being that we get up to, that we participate in. When we are in relationship with ourselves and other people, for example, superiority, right? Which is a part of the kind of genesis story of how HELD came together in what we recognized within us that, we participate in creating a pedestal or a hierarchy where you have the students who don't know enough or don't know anything, and the teachers or the facilitators who have come to make you the right kind of person. That's something that we understood about ourselves that we were participating in, and then we wanted to actively with intention dismantle. And so with that workshop, it's very much about identifying those different ways of being that are oppressive, and then figuring out what are the alternative ways of being in a way that I can relate to people, bridge differences, and I think ultimately be much more compassionate of the human condition and what it means to be part of humanity.
You know, it's funny, you answered three of my questions. One was, how do cultural, societal, and demographic factors such as age, gender, ethnicity, and so on affect our conversations? The other was, are there neurological and cognitive triggers, roadblocks, and systemic structures that get in the way of our conversations? And what kinds of conversations trigger fear and denial and change our brain and body chemistry? And you addressed all of those. But I loved how you pulled all of those complexities into the dynamics of a conversation, the differences, the chemistry, the emotion, the cultural, the historic, all of those things are so important. Is racism and prejudice innate, or is it learned through the discussions in everyday life from our families, from media, from books, and so on?
For me, very clearly and straightforwardly, it is a product of the environments that we are born into. I do not believe even for a second that it's innate, which isn't to say that there isn't such a thing as human nature. It isn't to say that there aren't parts of human nature that I will forever be perplexed by and wonder, like, where does that come from? So I'm not here saying I've got it all figured out. I don't. I see that there are certain human tendencies that that exist and that we're all capable of, and the practice, as James Baldwin, who was a fantastic human being, and I wish I'd known him, what he talks about, the decision to not participate in those things, the decision to not be that police officer, the decision to not be the monster that we're finger pointing to. And so I recognize that there is a thing such as the human condition, and that we are all born into it and we are all capable of it. And so as soon as we get into the territory of, I would never do that, I would never be that person, or I'm not capable of doing X, Y, Z, I have, that's a fallacy. It's more about the decision to not be. That is what we are building at Held, responsibility and discernment about what it means to not participate in those things. I share that to say there are still parts of the human condition that are fascinating to me that I don't understand. And I think that sometimes there are things that are inherent to what it is to be human. So there's that. However, I don't think racism and prejudice and different types of prejudice are one of the inherent things about who we are as human beings. And I think to say so is to fall into the very pseudoscientific nonsense of racism, which determines and essentializes people by saying this is who you are because of a particular trait that you have, whether it's the color of your skin, whether it's the shape of your nose or the texture of your hair. And I will forever actively challenge that, in not falling into that trap of believing that you can know who a person is, whether it's white people, black people, brown people, and all of the people in between on the spectrum that is, for example, race, that you can know who they are because of what they look like, is a fallacy, a myth, and a construction of human, I guess, like what it is to be human, that I will never believe in. So I think that it is a product of our environments. I do have that we learn racism and different prejudices very quickly, very young. That has been shown in, you know, scientific studies and research and experiments time and again with children demonstrating prejudiced attitudes, you know, picking one doll over the other, for example. That's been shown very, very young in kids. So we learn it fast, but it's not, I don't believe we're ever born with that attitude or way of being. I think we absorb it from the world around us. And I also think that as adults, these constructions of identity and reality serve people in getting their needs met. It doesn't justify that mechanism. It's a reality that I think we need to look at, which is the ways in which people are politicized or radicalized because they're not getting their needs met. And so the question is, how do we create a world in which all of our needs get to be met so that nobody has to be the scapegoat for that?
Interesting comment that you made about how we learn racism fast. In contrast, we unlearn it very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the world is more polarized today than ever before?
I think probably and unfortunately, yes. I understand that there have been generations before me that have been met with challenges of polarization more severely than, you know, my 3 decades on this earth could probably ever imagine. So it's not to make the challenge unique to this moment. We obviously know it's not. However, there are certain conditions that I think exacerbate the polarization and profit from the polarization in a way that feels specific to our time. And I think, you know, it's the go-to, but it's the go-to for a reason because it takes up such a big chunk of our lives, which is the internet and the ways in which the internet closes the gap in terms of time and space. And it means that we're more distanced from the consequences of not only holding particular opinions in the world, but imposing them on other people in the comment section of a particular, like, Instagram or Twitter post. And that is fueled by, encouraged, manufactured, reinforced by the machinery of social media. And it's not to blame everything on social media. Ultimately, social media is a tool and we decide how we use it or not. But there is a profit machine that I think contributes to the way in which we are more divided than I think we have been for either a very long time or in human history. It also, I think this moment is also unique in that, like, this is the furthest that we've been in human history, and people are tired of not being cared for. People are tired of not getting their needs met. And there's just so much history, there's so much historic kind of baggage that comes with, for example, being from a marginalized background. To give one example, right? But not to only kind of see that happening there. And I see the ways in which blame and punishment are the tools that we pick up again and again and again to make sense of an uncertain future, to make sense of the unacceptable pain, suffering, and trauma that has become normalized in our society. Like, one of the things for me that I just continue to be bewildered by is how in a modern Western societies, homelessness is something I genuinely can't get my head around it, that homelessness is a thing that is normal and that we ignore. And so there's a lot of pain and fear and in this world. And I think the polarization is, I think the pain and the fear is a breeding ground for that polarization. We can't make sense of it. And it's a lot. It's a lot to try and rationalize. And the easy narrative, or the easy way of doing that, is to point the finger and say that it's because of you, as opposed to it's because of us. The pain and the grief of what it means to live in today's society makes it very easy for us to move into blame and punishment and finger pointing and division and hatred and prejudice and all of these things that ultimately contribute to the polarization that I think we're seeing on a scale that we don't know what to do with anymore, that I'm not sure if we know how to get out of it anymore.
Yeah, I was quite struck by your comment of blame and punishment, because we certainly see that today, especially with Israel and Palestine. So are there ethical considerations when involved in conversations that are aimed at reducing polarization, such as issues related to power dynamics, respect for diversity, or potential unintended consequences like the ones we're talking about? Are there things we can do to change the conversation?
Yeah, this is a question that I think at HELD we continue to grapple with, because there's never a particular right way of doing it where everybody feels safe and everybody feels satisfied and cared for. And like, there's never one way of trying to build, how can I put it, of trying to bridge difference that feels like it's like the ethical way of doing things. So it's something I share from a very humble place, that it's something that we continue to juggle and grapple with. I think in terms of, or rather, let me start with somewhere that we are learning from and that we are, you know, in partnership with, is with the OBI, is with the Othering and Belonging Institute and the Democracy and Belonging Forum, and thinking about the ways in which they are building a world in which radical belonging, which everybody gets to belong, and therefore bridging communities that are experiencing difference and experiencing fracture. When it comes to power dynamics, there are a few things to think about, which is that, first of all, it's important to recognize that they exist and be careful of, therefore, how we relate to those power dynamics in a particular, for example, bridging conversation. Are we kind of over-indexing on power imbalance to such an extent that we are allowing it to stop us doing the work of bridging? Are we ignoring it altogether and not actually taking care of people and recognizing the consequences of being in a power relationship that is imbalanced? So I think it's definitely about like trying to find a more grounded way of relating to power, recognizing that there's more types of power than just power over and power under, or structural power, that we also have personal power, that there's different types of power that we can draw on in any given conversation or relationship, and broadening our perspective of what power means. And how it flows and shifts and changes, and where we locate it, I think is a really important practice to be in. But it is something that is hard to do, particularly when the predominant experience of power has been one of oppression and abuse. that can be really hard to take care of if we're talking about it from an ethical perspective. That can be hard to take care of in a bridging kind of conversation or relationship. So yeah, I think that is something to be cognizant of. And then to really think about, okay, how do we want to navigate this power imbalance? Is it as extreme as we think it is? What do we need to do to take care of it, including like being super transparent about power imbalance, giving people a way out, giving people an escape route of being like, actually, this isn't for me, providing emotional like resource, right, and care for people who are kind of navigating different levels of power in a relationship. So yeah, I think there's quite a lot to think about there.
Yeah, no, no kidding. Again, I think this speaks to the complexity and the layers in a conversation. Alicia Garza from Black Lives Matter says we need to bring love and compassion into our conversations. So where the differences exist, we can find our way into a deeper and more meaningful conversation. What about the emotional parts of a conversation? You know, those cognitive triggers or those emotional hotspots where our body chemistry changes.
Yeah, I think it is definitely a journey of quite deep inner work and self-awareness building. Mm. For me, and I'm still mastering the ways in which my body takes over when I am in a conversation of difference. I'm still on that, very much on that journey. And so I speak from being an apprentice in this alongside everybody else, which is that building the self-awareness to know what parts of like what's coming up in my body and like being able to identify and locate, I have this feeling, which is going hand in hand with this physiological response, right? Whether it's increased body temperature, like I'm in a hot flush or I've got a dry throat or my stomach is feeling queasy or heavy, or like whatever it is, like a increased heartbeat, but being able to first of all identify where is it showing up in my body and what is sitting and what is the feeling sitting like that is sitting underneath that physiological manifestation in me. So for me, I often, when something is knocking me off my balance a little bit, because I'm being confronted with a different perspective that I find triggering or activating, usually I go into my stomach. Like I feel most things in my core. I have come to know that about myself. There will be moments where I have more of a dry throat or I get sweaty palms. Absolutely. But the thing, my kind of like defining characteristic when it comes to how my body is firing up or trying to manage a fear or a threat of some kind, which is often what difference poses. It like for me, I know I'm in my belly right now. Like I can feel the nerves there. I can feel the unease or the anxiety or whatever. That's where it lives. So I think really kind of mastering the kind of somatic presence, if you like, of like, that's what that is showing up in me, and this is where that's coming from is really important. And then I think in doing that, it also creates space to recognize how that is, not even how that is showing up in other people, that it is true for other people as well, in like, I'm having feelings at the moment and they feel really strong. And right now my brain and body is telling me that I am under threat, right? Because that being able to understand that our bodies, our brains are literally built to keep us alive. So, and are like incredible detectors of threat and danger and risk, but sometimes overcook it as well, right? So being able to discern and be like, am I actually in danger here? Or am I being challenged by something that feels dangerous? And so something that we do at HELD in our work is support people to differentiate and discern between the difference between unsafety and discomfort. They often feel almost identical, if not the same. And you will hear people say, I'm not safe in this conversation, which is distinct to, I feel deeply uncomfortable in this conversation. But people often conflate it because they feel very similar. And so it's being able to start to build the self-awareness to be able to feel like, oh, I feel like I'm in danger and my stomach is telling me so. And so then I might move into flight, freeze, fawn, et cetera, or move into some kind of defensiveness. Being able to recognize that about ourselves and then try to think about like, oh, okay, what's needed for me in this moment? Do I need to pause? Do I need to step back? Do I need to sleep on it? Do I need to decide that actually I'm not living in reality right now, that I'm living more in perception than I am in reality? What do I need to do? And recognize that that is also something that the person on the other end may also be experiencing. And so to give an example of this that I want to share is being in a dialogue with someone recently about the Israel-Palestine issue, and they had very different views to my own. The perspective that they were coming from was that Hamas is out to kill Jewish people, and specifically Jewish people. And for me, what immediately came up was Hamas aren't trying to kill Jewish people. Hamas are trying to kill, resist against, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, against Israeli occupiers. And that was the narrative that came up in me. And both of us were incredibly irritated with each other. And like, I could feel it. I could see it on them. Like, we were both like mirroring like deep frustration and irritation that my accusation for that person was, how can you not see? And their accusation was, how can you not see? And we're talking about the history, like different histories in that one conversation, the history of anti-Semitism for them, and the history of colonialism for like that I was born into. And so being like, even though it felt really uncomfortable to be in it in that moment, also with a bit of time and space, I was also able to be like, they're in it too. And both of us are like, feel like we have to, that we're fighting for something. We're fighting against what it feels like to lose something precious, to lose safety, to lose dignity, to lose belonging. And so I think there's the very physical management of feelings, but there is also like a compassionate kind of understanding that we are often speaking from our feelings and our feelings aren't always reality, not always. And so coming with that consciousness and awareness of self is really important.
No, I think this is terrific. It speaks to the neurological, cognitive triggers, roadblocks, systemic structures, and ideologies that get in the way of establishing trust and understanding of various issues. I thought your example was terrific. I really liked your comment about discomfort, and I took away from that that discomfort is really an invitation.
In what way?
To be self-reflective. I look at discomfort as a learning opportunity, mm-hmm. or an opportunity to unpack something, you know, something that I've carried with me for a lot of years. I really appreciate your sharing that story with us, because it really highlights, I think, and it speaks to the complexity of those conversations that we have.
Yeah. And I think what I really value that experience as well, that those experiences of being exposed to difference, while they feel deeply unsettling, uncomfortable, threatening, and all of that is true and absolutely legitimate. There's so much gold in those moments, in the same way there is with conflict, right? Because it's teaching us about like what needs to change here, because something needs to change because we're in conflict. And that wisdom we have learned at HELD from Luna Hewson and their conflict transformation work. And so I really value that experience because it helped me to to build more empathy and compassion for the fear and the pain that a community different to my community that I'm identifying with in this moment, which is my African descendants, and like seeing the world through a colonial lens, because I've been taught to fear the consequences of colonialism, right? And so that's the lens at which I look at the issue of Israel-Palestine. I look at it through a lens of apartheid and occupation and colonialism and war and like the military industrial complex. And what that moment, political stuff aside, taught me was to see another human being also in fear. Also in fear of like the cyclical history of prejudice and discrimination against Jewish people. And this being yet another example of that being manifested. And I have taking some time to breathe a little bit after the conversation, was able to like come back and tune it and like plug into that and build my capacity for compassion with like, I see that that's what's scary for you right now. And what's scary for me is the repetitive cycle of colonialism. What does it mean to bridge those two, like our fears in this moment, even though they look and sound quite different?
Well put. What haven't we talked about that we should?
What else?
We've run through most of my questions, and I don't want to miss anything about Held and the work you do. Mm-hmm. One of the questions would be, how can we find you? How can our listeners learn more?
Yeah, thank you for asking, because we often don't make that much noise about ourselves. And I think that's in part because we've really taken the time to kind of incubate what we like, our vision for the world, and build our relationships with each other. And that's required some quiet time, like flying under the radar and doing the work both outwardly and inwardly. So yeah, we're getting more into the practice of sharing who we are and leading from our visions for the world of collective liberation. So if collective liberation and anti-oppression education is something that you're interested in, then and conflict transformation as well, then you can find us at our website, which is www.heldcollective.com. You can find us there. You can also give us an email. We're always up for seeing whoever kind of appears in our inbox with a story or a challenge or a question. Like it can be anything, and doesn't have to be some kind of like transaction, because that's something that we're also trying to actively dismantle in the world, which is this kind of always assumed transactionality about how we're in relationship together. So you may just have something you want to share. Get in touch with us, hello@heldcollective.com. And that is actually our email address, and we will actually answer, even if it's sometimes a little bit slow because we're very busy. And then you can find Alex and Priya on LinkedIn, Alexander Lyons and Priya Guy on LinkedIn. I'm not on LinkedIn, but you can find them there. I think that's we will be starting a Substack in the new year. We haven't officially launched it just yet, so I don't have the handle or the website just yet. But if you look on our website, you'll find all of the information there. And we're very happy to support you in whatever is emerging in your practice as anti-oppression and practitioners or someone who believes that everybody deserves to be free in the world, regardless of identity, positionality. Anything. So get in touch.
Vanessa, I really want to thank you. I could spend another couple hours, getting to know you better. And I love what you're doing. I'm grateful that you and the collective are together, that Held are together.
Thank you.
It's incredibly important work.
Thank you so much as well for inviting us on. It's lovely to be invited to have such meaningful conversation about tricky stuff, about tricky things in the world, and really continuing to answer this question about what does it mean to come together in the context of polarization, and to live alongside with the differences. not eroding, not suppressing, not sweeping under the carpet, but actually what does it mean to live with differences and all. So, yeah, thank you for stewarding these conversations. It means a lot.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks, Don.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
We've been talking with Vanessa Folloy, who's one of the founders at the Held Collective in London, England. You can learn more about their liberating work online and at theheldcollective.com. Sticks and Stones, Roots and Bones is part of my dissertation research project with the University of British Columbia. It's also a radio program and podcast produced at the Conversation Lab in Vancouver's downtown Eastside on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. You can find out more at theconversationlab.ca, on community and campus radio stations across Canada, and on your favorite podcasting platform. To make sure you don't miss the next episode, please hit subscribe. Thanks to my supervisory committee, Drs. Manel Matani, Janice Stewart, Denise Ferrara de Silva, Jan Fook, and Andy Hoffman, my cohort at UBC Social Justice Institute, friends and family who support this passion project, and Jason Shaw, who composed the music for us. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Schaefer.
Thanks to everyone who donated to CKUT's annual funding drive. Your generosity truly helps keep our engines burning. It's never too late to donate. You can do so by calling 514-907-9424 or going to ckut.ca and hit the green Make a Pledge button at the top. All paid entries will be entered into a grand prize draw. You can pay your pledge and pick up your gift weekdays between 11 to 6 p.m. or by appointments. Call 514-907-9424. Thank you.
Not what I got.
Bonsoir tout le monde.